Good evening and welcome to a slightly shorter than usual edition of A Critical Ear. My name's Andrew Boyle. With me today is Bob Naiman. Good afternoon, Bob.
Good afternoon, Andrew.
And in today's show, we're going to try to cover a range of topics, starting off with Gaza. You've been reporting this week that there's some movement on issues around Gaza at the U.S. House of Representatives, where there's a number of letters in front of the House?
Yeah. So one reason, of course, this is on many people's mind is because we're coming up on the 27th, on the anniversary, the one-year anniversary of the U.S., of the U.S., Freudian slip, the Israeli invasion of Gaza, December 27th of last year, which, as I argued at the time, was also a U.S. invasion of Gaza because it wouldn't have been possible without the approval of and support of the Bush administration. Today, Gaza remains under siege, under a blockade by the Israeli government, supported by the Egyptian government, and also by the U.S. government. So there are a couple of initiatives in the U.S. House of Representatives trying to challenge or ameliorate the suffering of the Palestinian population of Gaza under the siege. There's a letter that's being circulated by Representative Jim McDermott and Representative Keith Ellison that calls on President Obama. It's a letter to President Obama calling on him to press for an ease in the blockade, making it easier for Palestinians, aid workers, and journalists to enter and leave Gaza, and also to improve the access of Palestinian civilians to basic necessities such as clean water, food, fuel, and medicine. And then there's also a letter being circulated by Representative Jim Moran of Virginia and Republican Representative Bob Inglis of South Carolina that specifically focuses on the issue of Palestinian university students from Gaza who have been prevented by the Israeli authorities from studying in the West Bank. And as their letter points out, for many Palestinian university students from Gaza, particularly young women, the ban by the Israeli authorities on their study in the West Bank amounts in practice to a ban on them continuing their university studies at all. For you know, practical, economic, and cultural reasons, in the case of the young Palestinian women. There was a recent case that got even some ink in U.S. media where a young woman from Gaza who was months away from completing her degree at Bethlehem University in the West Bank was deported to Gaza by the Israeli authorities under their policy, even though they didn't have any evidence, nor did they claim that she was a security threat to the Israeli state. She was a young Christian woman studying accounting at Bethlehem University, which is a Catholic college sponsored by the Vatican. So just this policy of harassment and collective punishment against the Palestinian civilian population that these members of Congress are seeking to lobby the Obama administration to push to redress. And in the case of, in particularly in the case of the restrictions on the study of university students, there's been some noise from the Obama administration, one of the reasons that it was written about in the Washington Post. But it hasn't yet resulted in a practical change in Israeli policy on the ground. So this is a positive development that these members of Congress are trying to do this. A number of organizations, including Just Foreign Policy, but also including you know, J Street, Churches for Middle East Peace, Jewish Voice for Peace, and others, Friends Committee on National Legislation, have been promoting these letters as a way of trying to move the Obama administration to do concrete to improve the situation for Palestinian civilians in the Gaza Strip.
Bob, if I can ask... go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead. No, you go ahead.
I was going to ask you, for those who may not be familiar with the process, what is the role of such a letter? This is a letter that they're asking fellow representatives to sign so they can forward it to the president. This is not looking for a resolution on the floor of the House. This is looking
not a resolution on the floor. To sign it. That's correct. The inside language is "Dear Colleague" letter, because you know that's the heading. The members of Congress draft a letter to an official of the administration. In the case of the first letter, the McDermott-Ellison letter, it's a letter to President Obama. In the case of the Moran-Inglis letter, it's a letter to Secretary of State Clinton. So they draft this letter to the administration official, and then they send the letter around to their colleagues and ask them to co-sign it. And then, outside groups write to their members of Congress and say, you know, please sign the so-and-so letter. Please sign the McDermott-Ellison letter. Please sign the Moran-Inglis letter. And so hopefully, you know, you try and get, you know, if you get like 40 members of Congress to sign the letter, then it's a signal to the administration, hey, people in Congress care about this. So, you know, that makes them more likely to take whatever action is requested. It doesn't require having a majority of members of the House.
So it's essentially relying on or showing the, I suppose, the moral force of a breadth of membership or chunk of members of the House and hoping to bring pressure on the administration that way.
Yeah, and to say, and also to indicate, particularly in a case where, you know, you're not asking for the moon, but you're asking, you know, for sort of more effort and energy in a direction where there's some indication that the administration might be willing to go anyway. You're saying that, you know, you've got backing from a block of members of Congress in doing this. So, for example, you know, the Obama administration has made some noises in the past, including President Obama himself, of concern for the humanitarian crisis in Gaza and the, you know, opposition to the Israeli restrictions, you know, where they stop the Palestinians from importing construction materials to, you know, rebuild after the destruction caused by the Israeli invasion. It's plausible that the Obama administration might, you know, push this more vigorously if 30, 40, 50 members of Congress would send a letter to the administration saying, yeah, do this, you know, take some action, make something, some concrete change. Then the Obama administration could say, oh, we have backing from members of Congress to do this.
Okay. And at justforeignpolicy.org, you're asking for members of the public to take action of their own and apply the moral pressure that they might bring to bear on their representatives and asking them to sign on to one or both of these letters.
Yes, absolutely. And in the case of Champion Urbana, we're asking people to write to Representative Tim Johnson. People can do that through our webpage. And, you know, it's an opportunity to, maybe he would sign it. He has, you know, sometimes does things like this. But also, you know, it's a vehicle for showing that, you know, there's people in the 15th Congressional District of Illinois that care about what's happening to people in Gaza and want the U.S. to do something to ameliorate its policy and alleviate the suffering there.
Mm-hmm. Moving away from the Dear Colleague letters and situation in Gaza, if we can move on, if you could give our listeners some updates on the situation in Afghanistan and news from there in the past week or so.
Yes, although if I could, I would like to say one more thing about Gaza, which is that on December 27th, there's going to be a big International and Palestinian March in Gaza to the Israeli border to highlight the blockade, and also the internationals will be bringing in humanitarian supplies to highlight the blockade. This is the international component is organized by Code Pink. More than something like 1,300 people from around the world, many from the United States, have signed up to go, and I will be going. So from December 27th to January 4th, I will be in Egypt and Gaza, and maybe and hopefully we'll have internet access, so I may even be able during that time to give a report from the ground.
Okay. So our listeners can watch out for news, hopefully during that trip. If not, of course, once you return, we will share your news and your reports with the airwaves. And as you'd mentioned earlier, the start date of that trip, the 27th, is the anniversary of the Israeli invasion of Gaza.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay. So onward to Afghanistan. What news from there?
Well, so the terrible news, of course, of the last few weeks, is that the Obama administration, at the conclusion of its advertisedly extensive review, the punchline, unfortunately, was that President Obama substantively agreed to 95% or 90% of what General McChrystal had asked for. Announced an escalation of 30,000 more troops to U.S. troops to Afghanistan, some of which are already in route, and in the short run, the response from Congress has been rather anemic. Just in the last day, the House approved the Defense Conference Report, which is the military funding. It's not explicitly for, it's what they were already planning to do before. It's not explicitly for it to pay for the escalation. But of course, what the Obama administration will do is, burn through that money faster because there's going to be 30,000 more U.S. troops. So the next round of political battle over this will be in January, apparently, because Representative Kucinich has said that he will introduce a privileged resolution in January calling for withdrawal from the U.S. military withdrawal from Afghanistan to compel a floor vote. But then after that, what might be the main battle is the battle over the supplemental war funding, which will come in the next few months, and which hopefully will occasion some effort by folks like Representative McGovern in the House and Senator Feingold
in the Senate
to put forward some kind of alternative, like demand for an exit strategy with a timetable for military withdrawal.
Mm-hmm. And this is one of the elements of Obama's speech, where he made reference to an exit strategy, but very much couched in conditional language, and also foreseeing starting the process towards an exit by a date, very much making removing any definite plans from the detail, or any sense of detail or plan commitments from it.
Yeah. So the on the one hand, on the other hand, is this Obama speech. He said in July 2011 we're going to start withdrawing troops, and the positive thing you can say about that, which of course at first the Obama administration was was, you know, they were kind of trumpeting that. See, look, it's not an open ended; it's not endless. But the true positive thing you could say about that is that until now, U.S. officials, President Obama, everybody else, and NATO officials refused to even discuss any date whatsoever in which there would be any change whatsoever in the U.S. and foreign military occupation of Afghanistan. So that is some kind of concession to begin talking about a date. And it has been controversial from the other side. Many Republicans have attacked the Obama administration for even mentioning that, you know, a date certain in the future, there's going to be a move towards withdrawing U.S. troops. On the other hand, of course, an exit strategy has at least two pieces. One is, you know, when it's going to start, and the other is when it's going to finish. And of course, the when it's going to finish is missing. And as you suggested, following the president saying this in his speech, administration officials started walking it back and saying, you know, well, yes, it's going to start then, but the pace will be determined by conditions on the ground. Secretary of Defense Gates even said, you know, well, maybe it'll be a handful. So they, you know, they gave a little bit, and then they started taking away. Another development, possibly in Obama's speech, was some pivot by the administration on really, I would say, the all important question of political reconciliation. In Afghanistan, political reconciliation with the Taliban insurgencies. And there was a report in the Washington Times today indicating that, in fact, U.S. officials are meeting with sub-commanders of Taliban leader Mullah Omar, and some kind of negotiation process is taking place. So if, you know, if that turns out to be real, that would be a sea change in U.S. policy. It's hard to tell how real it is, but, you know, it's something that it appears to be at least some kind of shift from the U.S. previous U.S. policy.
And something that we'd talked about here on this show for some time as a necessary part, it would appear, of moves towards a resolution and away from purely military issues is you know, you have to engage with those you see as your enemy, not just you know, it's easy to engage with your friends. You need to try to engage with those with whom you have conflict.
Absolutely, and in this particular case, I think, you know, every dispassionate or and even passionate, you know, observer, people that are experts in the region acknowledge, you know, U.S. officials have acknowledged that the end game is a negotiated solution. So if you concede that the end game is a negotiated solution, then you want that to start as soon as possible. You want, because obviously, you know, it's not going to take a day to negotiate a solution. So, you want the negotiations to start as quickly as possible so they can conclude as quickly as possible, so the war can end as quickly as possible, so the killing can stop.
Yeah, I'm afraid we just had a little bit of a breakup from you at this end over our Skype connection. Bob, we want to wrap this up in the next minute or so. Next few minutes, you wanted to talk about the upcoming election in Haiti and what the situation is there. Something in the Western Hemisphere.
Yeah, the it was already there. There is an ongoing problem in Haiti, which is an increasing constriction of the political space. There was already an election that took place. In which the most popular political party, FAMI Lavalas, which is the political party associated with ousted former president Jean-Bertrand Aristide, FAMI Lavalas was excluded by the Electoral Commission from the last Senate elections. So that made many people in Haiti and elsewhere say, well, you know, this isn't a legitimate election if you're excluding the most popular political party. Nonetheless, these elections were accepted by the U.S., the U.N., and the OAS, all of which are deeply involved in Haiti. There's a U.N. Peacekeeping mission supported by the U.S., and the U.S., you know, funds these elections. So it's not, so the U.S. is deeply implicated in this process, and we seem to now be involved in another round of this. Last month, the Electoral Commission in Haiti excluded an even, you know, much larger group of political parties, 15 political parties, including FAMI Lavalas, from the parliamentary elections scheduled for February and March of next year. So, unfortunately, so far the U.S. has been pretty quiet. This hasn't been getting a lot of attention in the U.S. Press. So some of the Haiti solidarity groups are starting to try and put some pressure on the State Department and the Obama administration to find its voice, because otherwise, you know, what's going to happen is that it will become a fait accompli, just like the events in Honduras became a fait accompli. And then the U.S. will say, well, oh, this is too bad, but what can we do? You know, we have to support the Haitian government, even though, as I said, it's the U.S. and outside donors are going to be funding these elections. So they can't really claim clean hands if these elections go forward under these circumstances.
Okay. And this is something then that we should continue to follow and bring to the attention of our listeners as we get more news of what's likely to happen in this election.
Absolutely.
Okay. Bob, unfortunately, we're going to have to cut it short and leave it at that for today. Thank you again for joining me, as always. And we will talk to you hopefully this time next week.
I look forward to it.
Okay. Good luck, Bob.
Thank you.